All right, so let's jump into this story. It has power, hidden identities, a plot that could have changed history. Yeah, we're going deep into the Book of Esther using Dr. Elaine Phillips' lecture as our, well, guide. You probably know the basics of the story, but today we're going beyond that, looking at the rising tension, the hidden identities, and those crazy, twists of fate, the things that make this story so captivating.
What's so fascinating is that it's more than a historical account. This book really digs into themes of faith, courage, and whether divine intervention really plays a role in human affairs.
So the setting is the Persian Empire. King Xerxes is ruling, and Esther, a Jewish woman, is the queen, hiding her identity. And remember her cousin, Mordecai. He saved the king's life, remember, a while back, by stopping that assassination plot. Dr. Phillips points out that this detail, although it might seem small, could actually foreshadow Haman's eventual downfall. And it all ties back to this ancient Persian idea of indebtedness. So even a small favor, created this like powerful obligation.
Absolutely. That's a really important point because it sets up this whole web of connections, right? And unspoken debts. It's like it becomes central to the drama that unfolds.
Now, things have been shaken up a little bit in the king's inner circle. Some advisors have disappeared, maybe from the king's paranoia after the assassination attempt.
Possibly, yeah.
And then you've got Haman rising to this position of incredible power. Dr. Phillips really emphasizes this rise, like pointing out these three powerful verbs. They're used in the text. The king made Haman great, lifted him up, and seated him over others. It feels very intentional, this language. Highlights Haman's dominance and the king's complete trust in him.
It's almost like watching a Shakespearean tragedy unfold. You know, the stage is set for a powerful fall from grace.
And here's where things get really interesting. So, to cement Haman's status, Xerxes decrees that everyone has to bow down to him. Now, for most people, this was just the norm. But for Mordecai, this creates a massive conflict.
Yeah, because it's more than just like a polite gesture in this context. The Hebrew words used for kneeling and prostration, korem umishtahaving, they're specifically used for worshiping God. And this is where Dr. Phillips's insights add a whole new layer to this. She argues that for Mordecai, bowing to Haman would be idolatry, like a direct violation of the First Commandment.
So it was a deliberate act of civil disobedience, a challenge to Haman's power, and a public statement of faith. It really makes you wonder what was going through his mind, making such a bold move in a society, I mean, where defying the king could mean death.
Absolutely. And it didn't go unnoticed. Haman's servants point out what Mordecai is doing, and they specifically mention his words or actions. It almost implies, a deeper resistance. What's interesting is Dr. Phillips suggests this could be a double meaning. It wasn't just the physical act of not bowing, but something Mordecai said or did that amplified his defiance.
So this wasn't just a snub. It was a direct attack on Haman's ego and authority. And Dr. Phillips explains that Haman's reaction, it wasn't just like typical anger. It was a deep seething rage, likely stemming from, well, this cultural context where honor and respect were like paramount. To have this public defiance, I mean, from a Jew, this would have been seen as a threat to his entire social standing.
Absolutely. And at this point, the story really takes a very dark turn because Haman's rage, it's so intense that he decides that punishing Mordecai just isn't enough. He wants the entire Jewish population within the empire gone. So it's this chilling escalation driven by this wounded pride and, frankly, a disregard for human life.
And the way he pitches this to the king is almost like cunning. He uses this vague language about the Jews, referring to them as a certain people who are dispersed and scattered with different customs. He even throws in this lie, about them not obeying the king's laws. He's painting them as a threat to the stability of the empire.
Oh, absolutely. And Dr. Phillips argues that this is a classic example of scapegoating. Haman is playing on existing prejudices and anxieties to manipulate the king. So it's like a chilling reminder of how fear and prejudice can be used to justify horrific acts, even today.
And then what's really baffling is that the king agrees without even asking a single question, demanding any proof. He hands over his signet ring, giving Haman the power to carry out this plan. It's almost unbelievable, like how casually he sentences an entire group of people to death.
It really does make you question Xerxes' judgment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Dr. Phillips suggests that, maybe this is a reflection of the dangers of absolute monarchy, mm-hmm. where no one, you know, dares question the ruler. But what do you think? Was Xerxes genuinely naive, or, you know, is there something darker at play here, like a deliberate turning of a blind eye?
It's a tough one to process. So the decree is sent out across this vast empire by couriers, you know, ordering the death of all Jews, men, women, and children. And it's set for a specific day, the 13th mm-hmm. of Adar, the day before Passover.
Right. And the choice of date is significant because Dr. Phillips points out that by choosing this date, Haman is deliberately twisting like this Jewish festival of liberation into a day of terror and destruction.
Wow.
So it's a calculated act of cruelty aimed at maximizing the psychological impact.
So while the king and Haman celebrate this horrific plan, like oblivious to the terror they've unleashed, the news reaches Mordecai. His response is immediate and heartbreaking. He tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and cries out in anguish.
Yes.
A very public display of grief and despair.
It's such a stark contrast to the indifference of the king and Haman.
Yes.
And Dr. Phillips argues that this public mourning wasn't just like a personal expression of grief. It was also a deliberate act of defiance. He's refusing to hide his sorrow and fear, choosing instead to publicly challenge, you know, the injustice of the decree.
Now, Esther, secluded in the palace, is initially unaware of this decree. When she learns about Mordecai's display, she sends him new clothes, urging him to stop drawing attention to himself.
Mm-hmm.
She's terrified of the potential consequences for both of them. It really highlights the precarious position she was in, like trapped between the world of the palace and this looming threat to her people.
Right. That's a really insightful observation, because she is living a double life with this immense pressure to maintain her facade while her entire community is facing annihilation.
And then Mordecai sends a message back that completely shifts the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape." He's reminding her that silence won't save her, and that her position comes with a responsibility to act.
Right. It's a pivotal moment.
Yeah.
Mordecai is challenging her to embrace her identity and to use her influence to protect her people.
And then he asks this question that, you know, always gets to me. "And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this?"
Yes.
This is where Dr. Phillips connects this story to a broader, like, theological theme.
Mm-hmm.
She suggests that Mordecai is implying that Esther's rise to power, it wasn't just chance, but part of a divine plan, a powerful message of hope and purpose, even in the face of overwhelming darkness.
It's a question that continues to resonate today, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It makes you think about the potential, you know, that we each have to make a difference, even when the odds seem stacked against us.
Esther, deeply moved by Mordecai's words, realizes she can no longer stay silent. She decides to act, even though, you know, she's aware of the danger. Like, appealing to the king without being summoned, that could be a death sentence.
It's a moment of incredible courage.
Yeah.
She's choosing to risk everything to save her people.
And that is where we'll pause for now. Welcome back. So, Esther's decided to approach the king. You know, a move that could cost her life. But before she does that, mm-hmm. she does something that reveals a lot about her character and her faith.
It's remarkable. You know, she doesn't just rely on her own, like, you know, wits or anything. She calls for a 3-day fast.
Right.
Asking her maids and the entire Jewish community in Susa to join her. And Dr. Phillips emphasizes that this wasn't, you know, like a typical fast for like purification or mourning. This was a desperate plea for divine intervention, like a communal act of repentance and prayer, you know, acknowledging their reliance on God.
It's a powerful image, like this entire community uniting in prayer, you know, knowing their fate hangs in the balance. And Esther's words at this moment really, you know, struck me. If I perish, I perish.
Right.
So like she's, you know, accepting the risk, surrendering her fate to something bigger than herself.
Dr. Phillips points out the incredible faith this reveals, because Esther isn't, you know, in denial about the danger, but she chooses to act anyway, you know, trusting that even if she dies, she'll have served a higher purpose.
So the fast ends, and it's time for Esther to face the king. She puts on her royal robes,
mm-hmm.
but this is no ordinary audience. Like, she positions herself in the inner court of the palace,
right
where the king will see her.
Right.
It was a huge risk,
yeah.
because approaching him without being summoned, I mean, that was a capital offense.
Oh, yeah. You can feel the tension building in this scene.
Yeah.
Dr. Phillips highlights the symbolism, you know,
mm-hmm.
Esther standing there waiting for the king to extend his golden scepter, the symbol of his mercy.
It's a visual representation of her vulnerability. and the king's absolute power.
Yeah.
And Xerxes sees his queen standing there, uninvited. I can only imagine what was going through his mind. But instead of anger, he's filled with concern. He extends the scepter, sparing her life, and asks, you know, what troubles you, Queen Esther? What is your request? He even offers her up to half the kingdom. I mean, that's a pretty big offer.
It makes you wonder, like, you know, what was motivating Xerxes?
Right.
Dr. Phillips suggests it could be, like, genuine affection for Esther, or maybe even, like, a political strategy, you know?
Right.
Was he trying to appease her before she made a request that might be inconvenient for him, you know? It really adds, like, a layer of complexity to their relationship.
But Esther doesn't jump right into her plea.
Right.
Instead, she invites the king and Haman to a private banquet. It's a brilliant move, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Gives her more time to strategize and keeps Haman in the dark, unaware that he's about to become the main course in this, you know, royal drama.
Dr. Phillips describes this banquet scene as, like, you know, a masterclass in suspense building.
Oh.
You have these three powerful figures with unspoken tensions and hidden motives simmering, you know, beneath the surface. And while they're, you know, enjoying their wine, the king,
right,
who's eager to please, repeats his offer. What is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted.
Esther is playing a dangerous game, but she's clearly in control. You know, she delays, again, carefully crafting her response. If I have found favor with you, Your Majesty, and if it pleases you, grant my petition and fulfill my request.
Yeah.
Come tomorrow to another banquet, and then I will tell you what I desire.
Yeah, so brilliant.
Yeah.
Dr. Phillips explains that Esther is using the king's eagerness, right, to her advantage,
right,
turning his anticipation into a weapon, like, against Haman. She's setting a trap, and Haman, blinded by pride, is walking right into it.
Speaking of Haman,
mm-hmm,
let's check in with our villain. He's thrilled with the banquet invitation. You know, he struts out of the palace feeling like he's on top of the world. But then he sees Mordecai, still refusing to bow. And all that joy, it turns to fury.
Yeah. This encounter, it highlights Haman's obsession with control.
Right.
Dr. Phillips argues that he can't stand even the slightest challenge to his authority.
Right.
And it also reminds us that his hatred for Mordecai, it's more than just personal.
Right.
It reflects this deep-seated prejudice against the entire Jewish community.
Fuming, Haman goes home. He boasts to his wife and friends, you know, about his wealth, his sons, his high position. It's like a child showing off his toys, except his toys are, like, power and influence. Then he reveals, you know, the one thing ruining his perfect moment, Mordecai.
It shows the emptiness at the heart of Haman's ambition.
Yeah.
You know, he's achieved everything he thought he wanted.
Yeah.
Wealth, status, the king's favor. But Dr. Phillips suggests it all means nothing to him as long as Mordecai continues to defy him. Mm-hmm. It's this, like, you know, portrait of how pride can consume a person from the inside out.
Haman's wife, Zeresh, seeing his distress, she offers a solution, you know, build a huge gallows and impale Mordecai in the public square.
Mm-hmm. Hey. Like a gruesome, vindictive plan intended to humiliate Mordecai and instill fear in the Jewish community.
And Dr. Phillips points out the symbolism of the gallows.
Right.
They represent, you know, like the ultimate expression of Haman's hatred, the threat hanging over the Jewish people. But they also, you know, foreshadow a reversal of fortune, like a hint that pride often comes before a fall.
And that's where we'll pause, you know, leaving you on the edge of your seat. We've got a king in the dark, a queen making a dangerous gamble, a villain plotting revenge. What will happen next?
Join us for part three to witness the climax of this incredible story and the surprising ways in which justice is served. Okay, we're back. Final part of our deep dive into the Book of Esther. So Haman, he's consumed by pride and vengeance, plotting to have Mordecai impaled on those gallows he had built.
Right.
Feels like everything's going according to his plan. But then, you know, there's this unexpected turn of events.
Yeah, this is where Dr. Phillips highlights that whole idea of divine intervention. Almost like an invisible hand is at work, you know, orchestrating events beyond human control.
So the king, he can't sleep.
Yeah.
He decides to have, you know, the royal chronicles read to him. Those detailed records of everything that's happened in the kingdom. And
yeah,
what do you know? He comes across the story of Mordecai saving his life by exposing the assassination plot.
Right.
It seems random. But Dr. Phillips argues that, you know, within the story, this is no mere coincidence.
Yeah.
It emphasizes that theme of hiddenness and revelation. You know,
uh-huh,
how past actions can come to light at the most critical moments.
Mm-hmm.
And the king, is suddenly hit with this wave of guilt. He realizes he never properly rewarded Mordecai. So he asks his servants who's in the court right now.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you know it, Haman is there, early in the morning, ready to ask permission to execute Mordecai.
Oh, wow.
Talk about bad timing.
Yeah, it's like Haman is being drawn into this, like, trap of his own making. Dr. Phillips suggests that his eagerness to destroy Mordecai, it's blinded him to the shifting tides, the sense that, you know, he's losing control of the situation.
The king, completely oblivious to Haman's real intentions, decides he wants to honor Mordecai publicly.
Yeah.
So he turns to Haman and asks for advice, you know, on how to best reward someone who has shown exceptional loyalty to the king.
Mm-hmm.
And Haman, assuming the king is talking about him, suggests this lavish parade.
Right.
The honoree would wear royal robes, ride the king's own horse, and be paraded through the city.
Oh, the irony. It's almost painful.
Yeah.
Dr. Phillips points out how Haman, in his arrogance, becomes the architect of his own humiliation.
Right.
He unintentionally proposes, like, the very honors that will be bestowed upon his enemy. It's that classic, you know, pride before the fall.
And so, to Haman's complete shock, the king orders him to lead Mordecai in this grand procession.
Wow.
Proclaiming his good deeds for all to hear. Haman is forced to swallow his pride and obey, becoming a participant in his own downfall.
It's such a powerful turning point.
Yeah.
Dr. Phillips argues that this public spectacle, it's not just about humiliation, but about, like, a reversal of power.
Right.
Mordecai is elevated and Haman is brought low. It also, you know, foreshadows the ultimate justice that awaits Haman.
Can you imagine the whispers spreading through Susa?
Yeah.
As people witness this? The man who was plotting genocide, now forced to honor the very person he wanted to destroy.
Right. And it also emphasizes, like, the theme of hidden identities that Dr. Phillips talks about.
Mm-hmm.
Mordecai's true worth is finally revealed. You know, his loyalty and courage acknowledged publicly. And it's this revelation that creates the perfect opportunity for Esther to, you know, expose Haman's treachery.
So over the second banquet, the king's in a good mood. The wine is flowing. He turns to Esther again, you know. What is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted.
Mm-hmm.
He's like ready to shower her with favors.
This repeated offer, like Dr. Phillips explains, builds up that drama surrounding Esther's request.
Right.
It highlights the weight of what she's about to ask and the potential consequences.
Esther doesn't hold back. She says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition."
Yeah.
"And spare my people. This is my request."
Wow.
The way she phrases this, it's significant. Dr. Phillips points out that Esther doesn't immediately accuse Haman or reveal her Jewish identity.
Right.
Instead, she frames her request in terms of personal loyalty and the well-being of her people, appealing to the king's sense of justice and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
The king is stunned. He demands to know who would dare threaten his queen and her people. And then, in this incredibly dramatic moment, Esther points to Haman and reveals his plot to annihilate the Jews.
It's the climax of the story.
You know,
the moment of truth. Dr. Phillips emphasizes how Esther's courage in exposing Haman is what sets in motion his downfall.
The king, furious at this betrayal, orders Haman's immediate execution on the very gallows that Haman built for Mordecai.
Right.
It's a classic example of poetic justice, you know, that would have the original audience cheering.
It's more than just, like, revenge, though. As Dr. Phillips explains, it reinforces that theme of reversal.
Right.
Haman's instrument of cruelty, it becomes the means of his own destruction. So it's a powerful reminder that those who seek to harm others often bring about their own downfall.
But the story doesn't end there. The king, he elevates Mordecai to a position of power, and Esther, using her influence, secures a new decree. It allows the Jewish people to defend themselves.
And that's important because it shows that Esther's bravery and Mordecai's faithfulness, it didn't just save their people from, you know, annihilation.
Right.
It secured their place within the empire. It's a testament to the power of speaking truth to power, even when it's dangerous.
So what can we take away from this deep dive into the book of Esther?
Mm.
We've seen how, you know, blinding pride can be, how courage can overcome fear, and how hope and justice can prevail, even in, like, the darkest moments.
Dr. Phillips's lecture really adds depth to this ancient story. It reminds us that even small acts can have a ripple effect, that faith can make a difference, and that each of us has a role to play in fighting injustice and protecting those who are vulnerable.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up, I'm, you know, left wondering, What acts of courage or defiance might you be called to in your own life? How can you use your voice and your influence, you know, to make the world a better place, even when it seems impossible? The story of Esther shows us that even when facing overwhelming odds, we can choose to stand up for what's right. And maybe, just maybe, we've been placed in our own positions for such a time as this.
Okay.